This audio file comes from the Labrie Ideas Library at www.labrie-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Labrie Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family, and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking prior permission from Labrie Fellowship.
Good. The title of the lecture, sorry I didn't give it to you beforehand, is Hobbits, Heroes and Jesus Christ. Is Christianity Just a Myth? I'd like to just go to explore some ideas of myth and then open it up for questions. So, but do stop me as we go along and ask questions, then we'll have a question time at the end as well. So, Hobbits, Heroes and Jesus Christ, is Christianity Just a Myth? Those of you that know me, I love myths, and I think I probably loved myths as long as I can remember. In fact, one of the study groups I ran a couple of terms ago was reading myths and thinking about them together. And myths and stories have fueled my imagination. And I think there's been a renewed interest in myths and heroes recently. And I guess, in a way, it's come back into our culture through film. There was a long time when we liked, since the anti-hero, the person, the rebel, that's been a genre for a long time. But then the hero, as opposed to the anti-hero, came back in. And I think Gladiator was the film that kind of seemed to spark it off for Hollywood. This unlikely thing of kind of redoing like Ben-Hur, but in the year 2000, making a film, and the success of that film, directed by Ridley Scott, starring Russell Crowe, it really seemed to tap into something that people wanted or wanted to make renewed contact with. And then we've had a whole spate of heroic kind of myth films. We had Brad Pitt as Achilles in Troy, Homer's Iliad, and then Oliver Stone made Alexander, the myth of the boy general or the young general conquering the world. And then we had King Arthur with Clive Owen and Keira Knightley as Queen Guinevere. And obviously Hollywood found that there was money in old-style heroes. And kind of in amongst those, of course, which we watched the other night, we had Lord of the Rings. Also a great mythic story, not set in the history of our Earth, but a mythic story of a heroic story. And I know then we have coming out in fact on the last day of term is The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and C.S. Lewis's heroic story myth. And in amongst all of these heroic stories, also something that came to mind was Mel Gibson's The Passion of Christ as well, maybe kind of in a way fitting into this genre of renewed interest in myth. The last 24 hours of Jesus' life, and is apparently now the second highest grossing film ever made. I don't know if anyone knows what the highest... No. Star Wars.
Not Titanic.
Well, a series of films. Okay. No, Titanic's the one that made most, isn't it, on its opening?
Yeah.
But in terms of, like, all time, in terms of, like, over the years...
Oh.
Star Wars is the highest kind of grossing film ever. All the spin-offs, which I'm buying for Jack for Christmas, the Star Wars spin-off, Millennium Falcons and Darth Vaders and what have you. So there's obviously, Hollywood's latched onto a lot of money in myth, and Mel Gibson has made a lot of money out of telling the story of Jesus Christ. And it occurred to me, it fitting into the genre, is it just another myth like these others? An old story set who knows when with fictional characters, perhaps loosely based in history but mainly fictional, some fantastic events, and the Passion of Christ is not a very exciting story initially when one compares it to The Lord of the Rings or to Gladiator. It doesn't seem a very exciting story. So these kind of thoughts triggered in my mind at this talk and asking the question, is Christianity just a myth? Is it just a myth that kind of slots in with these other myths? And I want to answer it in two parts tonight. And the first part, I want to say yes, Christianity is a myth. And that might freak out some of you. Might freak out. I might have to resign my position as a worker at Labrie. But I'm going to explain what I mean by talking about what I see a myth is and how myths function. And then I'm going to explain why I think Christianity is a myth in those terms. And then the second part, I want to say why Christianity is more than a myth. So I want to say it is a myth, but it's more than a myth. And those are the two bits I want to try and fit together. Now I think as I begin to talk about myth, I want you to kind of, if you can, try and put away any kind of preconceived ideas that you might, or words you might attach to the word myth, ideas you might attach to it. But I want to just explore what are the elements of a myth and try and give you my definition for what a myth is. And you might want to substitute another word, perhaps you could say story or narrative, might, you know, be other ways you could put it. And I think this lecture goes well with Jeff's lecture he gave on narrative theology and the ideas of narrative that he gave earlier in the term. Now, I love mythical stories right from the very beginning. My parents both studied classics at university, and what I can remember, you know, my dad reading us the stories of Odysseus in the children's edition, actually, that I have here for Jack. And the story of the Cyclops was always the most exciting story for me, the one-eyed monster. And then the return home of Odysseus when he arrives home disguised as a beggar. I don't know if you know that's the story. And then his old dog has been thrown out by the suitors in his palace, thrown out and is dying on the dung heap. But his dog recognizes him, even though he's disguised, and just kind of wags its tail and then dies. It's a very sad story. That's one that always stuck in my mind as well. I think then I graduated as soon as I could read myself onto reading the Narnia stories. And then quickly moved on to The Lord of the Rings. And I think Lord of the Rings as a story, as a myth, you know, captured my heart and imagination more than any other story has. And it is almost a myth beyond equal, although I think the Silmarillion, in a sense, is, in terms of mythical myth-type literature, is a better example. But Lord of the Rings is in some ways a fuller story. And I don't know about you, but I think from when we had the Lord of the Rings evening, you're kind of joined in that in a great way, which showed that I think probably some of you share with me that idea that when you read The Lord of the Rings, or maybe when you see the film, but especially when you read it, you want it to be true, a story that you want to be true, because it's so much more exciting than everyday life. And I really thought as a child when I read it, I wanted to be as heroic as Frodo and go on a quest, you know, something big to do in life like Frodo has. And then we turn around to our normal humdrum lives, and how does it relate to us? And when I was doing this myth group, remember one of the girls said in the group, we were reading a King Arthur story, and she said, you know, you read King Arthur and you get the sense of this heroic world and these great stories and great events, and then you turn around and you have to do the washing up. And how does it work? But I want to think about the elements that make up a myth. And it doesn't matter, I think, whether the myth is set in the past or the future. You could equally have tried to think about things like King Arthur as well as Star Wars, for example, as a good example of a modern myth. And so, rather than thinking like myth is something untrue or you know, made up or make-believe, I just want to draw out these elements about what I think makes up a myth. And the first thing about a myth is that there's always a big story in a myth. And this is the backdrop against which everything happens. It's like the big view. And it actually makes the story important, the story of the myth, this big story that's the backdrop. It gives it significance. And I think probably all the great myths have as their background story the struggle of good and evil, the titanic battle between good and evil. If you think of King Arthur, you have the Christian King Arthur fighting against the pagan hordes of Denmark as they try to invade. Or you think of Star Wars, the Rebel Alliance versus the Empire of Darth Vader. And in Lord of the Rings, of course, you get you know, probably one of the best depictions of the reality of evil ever, and then the free peoples of Middle-earth standing against Mordor. So there's a big story in myth, and there's also a little story, though, in myth. And although in many myths there are the heroes, Lancelot, Aragorn, Achilles, whoever, myths also have a lot to do with ordinary people. And Lord of the Rings is a great example here of Frodo and the Hobbits. Or you get in Star Wars the farm boy Luke Skywalker, or in Lord of the Lion, the Witch, the Wardrobe, the four children who go through the wardrobe. And there's this little story, in a sense, of these ordinary people who get caught up somehow in the big story. And that, in fact, it's their faith and courage on which the outcome of the big story depends so often. So we have a big story, and then the little story, little people, and then within that, the idea of a quest, or you might call it an adventure or a journey, or something that, you know, to be done, to be achieved, a journey that, and it's the journey that the little people must go on. And often they don't understand or see the significance of what they're doing in the quest. And Frodo in the Ring is a great example. Frodo has really no idea for most of the film about what he's, most of the book rather, about what he's doing. And there's a part in the film which actually isn't in there, I don't think, in the book, but I like the way that they brought that out, is when Frodo's in Rivendell with the elves, and they have the Council of the Ring, and they form the Fellowship of the Ring, and then, you know, now these nine will take the ring to Mount Doom, and there Frodo strides out at the head of them, and immediately he leaves the doors of Rivendell. There's a fork in the road, I don't know if you remember, and he whispers to Gandalf as they're walking along, you know, which one goes to Mordor? And he's got no idea really even where he's going, and yet his little part, in a, as it were, his faithfulness, his courage, is the central kind of event almost, but it's part of his little story that decides the big story. So those are three of the elements: the big story, the little story, the idea of quest. And then in the myth, I think there's always great tragedy in a myth. There's a moment when it appears that evil has won, and every myth has that in it. Balrog pulls Gandalf to his death in the chasm of Moria, and how can the rest of the company, since, get by without Gandalf? Darth Vader kills Obi-Wan. You know, so it's also a classic, the great tragedy. Frodo is stung by Shelob and captured by the orcs. Or Aragorn, you know, at the end, and the tiny band of free peoples at the gates of Mordor as this huge host of evil creatures come out at them. So there's great tragedy, but also in the myth, there's always a twist as well. There's also a twist. So there's this time when all hope is lost, but then there's a twist, and it's just at the moment, actually, when all hope is gone and everything seems shattered, that hope is reborn. And in fact, it's often in myths that at the moment of the seeming triumph of evil, it's actually there when the purposes of good come about most fully. So you can think of Gandalf the Grey, killed by the Balrog, returns as Gandalf the White, stronger, more powerful, more wonderful. Obi-Wan slayed by Darth Vader, but as becoming kind of part of the Force, he then has a far more powerful influence in events. And Frodo does make it to Mount Doom. And the last, there's that twist, and then the last thing I wanted to say about myth is the way that myth works for a group of people. And this is something that myth does, is myth becomes a story which forms the consciousness of a community. So in the Greek city-states, for example, the reading of the Iliad and the Odyssey was, in some of the Greek city-states, was a civic duty that you had to attend as a citizen. And the idea was that by hearing about the heroes of old and the stories in which they were involved, you partook in the values that that community wanted to embody. I don't know how many of you, since you've been, have taken the opportunity to visit Winchester. And who's been to Winchester? Since you've been, a few of you, and visited the Great Hall. Did you visit the Great Hall in Winchester? Where up high on the wall is King Arthur's Round Table. Big round table, but the legs are taken off. It's put up on the top of the wall so everyone could see it. But it was actually made in the kind of 13th century, I think, that table. Not by King Arthur himself, but by, and I always forget whether it was Henry II or somebody like that, I can never remember which English king it was, who made that table. But what he wanted to do in making that table, obviously, if there was a King Arthur, which I think there probably was a true figure that this these myths, stories were based around, but hundreds of years later, for the English king of that time, he wanted to say to his people that I embody the values of King Arthur, and that was why he had this round table made. And in fact, it's interesting that it's probably his own portrait. There's a picture of King Arthur on it, but it's obviously the king, King Henry II himself, that is there. And then there's the list of all the knights around him. And what he's saying to his community is, these are the stories which form our community, the things that embody the way I want to be as a king, and the way perhaps I want to be seen as a king, and the way we are as a community, the chivalry, the Christian king, as it were, protecting his people against, you know, the forces outside, forces of evil, however he wanted to say it. That's what he wanted to say. So a myth or a story always becomes, or not always, but it becomes the consciousness of a community, and that's how myths were supposed to function. We can talk about more about that later. So that's what I think a myth is. It's got those elements in it. There are others, I'm sure. Second thing I wanted to draw out in talking about myth is, what is the importance of myth for us? Why does myth seem to be so important? It's the, you know, narrative is the earliest form of writing, these stories, you know, things like Beowulf, some of the oldest things we have, the Norse legends, the oldest writing we have. And I think why myths are so important is because they help us overcome a problem of human knowledge. And I just want to spend 5 minutes laying out what that problem is and how myths overcome it. This is the problem of human knowledge, is that there are two types of knowledge that we have. There is thinking about something with our head. You might call that abstract thought, analytical knowledge. And then there is knowledge through experiencing something. Okay, you get the difference between the two. You can think about something or you can experience it. But one of our problem is that in our kind of fractionless as humans, we can't do both at the same time. We can't both experience something and think analytically about it. Kissing is a great example. If you are engaged in a passionate kiss, you experience the passion of the kiss. But if you start to think abstractly and analyze what is happening as you kiss someone, then you take away the passion and the experience of it. You begin to lose that. And it works the other way around. So that it works in both these ways. The more that you analyze something, the less you experience it. And the more you experience something, the less you can analyze it. So if you want to start analyzing, you know, what happens in a kiss, and then your boyfriend or girlfriend comes up and starts kissing you passionately, you begin to lose, because of the experience, the ability to see it in an abstract way. And we have difficulties, human, bringing those two things together very often. Some of us live much more in the abstract world. And this is where Andrew's lectures about introspection, being stuck inside my head, living inside my head. It's very true that we're totally stuck in the abstract, and that stops us experiencing the world firsthand. Some of us are stuck in our experiences. I think children are very stuck in their experiences. Actually, you know, if I ask Jack in the afternoon, what did you do at school in the morning, he can never tell me. And it's not because he can't remember, but just because he lives in the moment so much that actually, you know, what happened this morning is miles and miles away. Or when Sam wants a biscuit and he doesn't get it, you know, he totally lives in the experience and he falls down on the floor and beats his fists against. Some of us still do that as adults, but some of us have learnt to think abstractly, but then forgot how to experience. Then we kind of are divorced as human beings in this way. And so what myth does, what story or narrative does, is that it forms the link between experience and thought, between experience and abstract thought. And I think what first happens as we read a story is that we actually experience a story. I don't know if you, The Lord of the Rings is a great example. It's, I don't know about you, but I really feel as I read it, even if I read it again for the second, third, fourth time, that you go on the journey with Frodo to Mount Doom. You know, that you participate in the story. You enter into it. It captures your emotions, your imagination. You know, you get excited at the exciting bits. You feel sad and lost when Gandalf dies. You feel the fear of, you know, the Black Riders or the Balrog or Sauron or whatever it is. And then the hope grows in you as Frodo gets closer to putting the ring in Mount Doom. So we first experience a story. We experience with Frodo the journey to Mordor. But then something else happens, actually. And it's quite hard to describe what happens, but various writers discuss it in different ways. And they all say that actually something else flows into us through the experience of the story. Paul Ricoeur called it a surplus of meaning. So like there's the meaning of the story itself, you know, the words Frodo went to Mount Doom, etc. But something else, actually a surplus of meaning. There's something more than that that comes into you and flows into you. And you actually can feel changed by that experience of reading the book. You know, you read Lord of the Rings and you feel more heroic. Perhaps you feel that you want to do something that's, you know, embodies. You read King Arthur and you get captured up in the story, but also at the end you feel like somehow you want to be more chivalrous. You know, you see life in a different way. I think what C.S. Lewis has said, what flows into us is, he calls it reality. It flows into us through a narrative. The surplus of meaning is reality or truth, you might say. Through the story, reality has flowed into us. And we actually understand more of reality with our minds because of entering into the story. It changes us, not just in our emotional experience, but in our being. And that's why the Greeks, for example, read the Iliad, the story of the Iliad, to their people in the Greek city-state, because they thought through the story the values of Achilles or of Agamemnon, the courage, the ideas of wisdom, the ideas of cunning, even from Odysseus, would come in and become part of the people that were hearing the stories. Susan McCauley makes a very similar point, I think, in For the Children's Sake, about reading stories to children, is picking stories where, you know, where the values, in a sense, you want those values that the characters have to come into the children. But it comes through the story, not by saying, you know, you must be kind, or you must be brave, or something, but actually just through hearing a story about kind and brave people, it flows into you. And science fiction is a great example of this as well, I think, because in a way you can't get more made up than science fiction, in the sense that it happens in the future. It can't even be a story based in history loosely, because it happens in the future. But what happens in science fiction usually is that, most science fiction is to do with some kind of artificial intelligence or robot or something like that. And what happens in science fiction is you make a world that's very much like our own, but you change one thing. You know, we have a robot who's developed artificial intelligence. And then you explore the story. And I think really the actual most science fiction is asking this question: what does it mean to be human? That's what, if you watch something even as poorly made film as I, Robot, or something like that. But Gattaca might do it better, or some other films. But as you see, like this, you know, an iRobot, this robot living out the story and kind of developing human feelings and emotions, it makes you ask the question, I think, you know, what does it mean to be human, to have these emotions and feelings, and, you know, what makes us human? So in that sense, reality flows into you through this story. So what myth does then is it unites, so these two parts of our human knowledge, experience and reason, or you might call it imagination and reason, and it unites the two together. It changes us, it inspires us, challenges us, and teaches us. So that's why I wanted to say that, why yes, Christianity is a myth, because I think it's just the kind of story that captures both our imagination and our reason. And I've often thought, and maybe you've thought the same, why didn't God give us a textbook of theology? You know, why didn't he give us a systematic theology? It would be a lot easier, in a sense, to work out our theology than having all these stories and narratives from which our theology is derived. But instead, actually, he gave us a story. A narrative. And the Bible is narrative from beginning to end. If you think, it starts the story of the Garden of Eden. It finishes with the story of the new heavens, the new earth. You know, it's narrative. And although, I think as Jeff pointed out, one must say there are many, many parts of propositional truth. But again, the propositional truth occurs within the story. Even Paul's letters, which contain lots of propositional truth, you know, that's by that I mean, you know, this is what is, a statement of, in a sense, what is, and what's true, a statement of what's true. They still, you know, Paul writes a letter to a certain people, and, you know, to some real people in a real place, with a real questions that they usually asked him. So that's a story, isn't it? He's writing a letter to someone. So it still takes place within story, but there is both story and propositional truth. But the Bible is narrative, really, from its beginning to its end. And I want to just lay out for you now what the Christian myth is, or the Christian story, the Christian narrative is, and how it actually embodies all those parts of myth that I pulled out. And I think God did that to capture both reason and imagination. So first of all, Christianity has a big story, doesn't it? It has the big story. There is the Creator, the God, who made the world beautiful and full of wonder. In a word, he spoke and it came into being. And then he made man and woman, made to love the Creator, the creation, love one another, in his image, naked, majestic human beings. And then in the big story, it all goes wrong. It all goes wrong. An angel is not content to be a creature. He starts to envy the Creator and then hate him. And eventually that angel's only desire becomes to twist and distort, to maim and destroy the beautiful creation. And in this big story, he then lures the man and the woman into his plans. He offers them power, like the power of the ring, isn't it? He offers them the power in return for their allegiance. And then, just like in all the myths, at this point, everything appears lost. The creation and the creatures descend into this kind of self-created chaos, destruction and hatred. And hope seems lost, but even in the midst of that, there's this promise. A promise that one day a king will come who will put everything right, who will defeat and banish evil, who will restore the beauty and wonder to the creation and to humankind. So that is the big story. It's a wonderful big story. And then, in the Bible, starts the little story. Think what the little story is. A man is chosen from amongst all the people of the world, one man whose line will lead to the king. The man has children and they grow into a family, and then the family becomes a tiny nation, but still tiny, surrounded by hostile enemies in whom this one little nation, the hope of the whole universe, lies. the little story, this tiny family growing. And evil tries to stamp out the hope again and again. Like in all the myths, there are moments when everything seems lost. The nation gets taken as slaves into Egypt, and Pharaoh orders all the boy killed. How can you have a king who will come if you have no boy children, no fathers? Later on, the Babylonians capture the nation. They kill all its men, they burn its cities to the ground, and they take its people into exile. Again, how can this little story come to fruition with no men, no cities, the women captives? And yet hope continues, doesn't it? The line goes on. The Bible lays that out beautifully, the beginning of the Gospels. The line goes on. And then the moment comes when the time is right and the promised king arrives. The hope of the universe for its, you know, its restoration is condensed in history into one very small story. And like all good myths, I think this story takes an unexpected twist, the Christian story, because everyone would expect God to come in his power, the king to come with his armies or his angels, and then suddenly we hear that the king has been born as a human baby, that the hope of the universe rests in this very frail and helpless little child. It's where the beginning of the Gospels really captures my imagination. You know, you think of, I was just watching the end of Revenge of the Sith, you know, when the two children are taken and separated and hidden away, Princess Leia and Luke Skywalker. You know, and in a sense, in them lies the hope. But even more frail, you know, this one child born in a manger, born in a stable, into poverty. And then you get this point where evil again tries to stamp out the hope. The king of the land sends soldiers to kill every boy in town, including that one boy. You again see, you know, the stormtroopers land on Tatooine, don't they, to get rid of Luke. But this little baby, this hope, escapes, warned in a dream. And then the hope remains hidden away for 30 years or so. A carpenter in a small village. It's just like Aragorn, you know, the ranger, hidden away in the northern waste, Luke Skywalker hidden in Tatooine, until the time is right for the return of the king. And then hope starts to grow. The hope, the man appears and he heals someone with a touch. He raises the dead with a word. He casts out an evil spirit. Wherever evil confronts him, It flees away. He teaches love and truth and wisdom, and evil hates him. Again, we get that in the Gospels. I mean, Tolkien in The Lord of the Rings brings out the idea of this growing, you know, hatred and evil better than anywhere else that I've found. But the Gospels do that too, the growing hatred. Now, the religious institutions hate Jesus because he's unorthodox. The civil institutions fear him because he's a rebel. And this time, then we get the tragedy, you know, the evil gets its man. They get Jesus and they kill him, they nail him to a cross, humiliating him, and the king is dead. And you get that moment in the Gospels when all hope is gone, hope is dead. But then, you know, you get this most extraordinary twist. Again, that very moment, just like in the other myths I've talked about, when evil thinks that it has triumphed over good, it's actually the moment when evil is finally defeated. In killing the king, evil has actually done the one thing which is required for the hope to become a present reality. And the king rises from the dead, just as Gandalf the Grey rises as Gandalf the White, stronger, indestructible, undefeatable. Evil cannot win, even though it will try to drag everything with it in its death throes. But it cannot win. The king is here and his kingdom will grow and grow and grow until all things are made new. So that is the Christian myth, if you like. And so I say yes, I say wholeheartedly, Christianity is a myth. In that sense, I mean, it's a narrative story. In fact, Tolkien called it the myth. called Christianity the myth. He said that all heroism and, or his idea was that all heroism and beauty, all courage in all the myths that we've ever read about and encountered and loved as children and as we go on loving as adults, all those things that we love in those are only there in as much as they reflect the Christian story. So Tolkien said this, the Gospels contain a fairy story, even the sum total of all fairy stories rolled together. I love that. I mean, the Gospels contain a fairy story, even the sum total of all fairy stories rolled together. So Christianity is myth, but, and here's, I want to move into the second point, it is not just a myth. It transcends myth, for it is also fact. Other myths, you know, you don't know where they occurred, when, which country, which places, you know. Is Winchester the seat of King Arthur? Is that where Camelot was? Or is it in Tintagel down in Cornwall? Or a number of, you know, 100 other places claimed in the British Isles. So myths, we said, where and when. But Christianity is a myth, but it's not just a myth. It transcends fact. It transcends myth, for it also a fact. It's a myth that enters real space and time, that enters history. So again, just quoting Tolkien, talking about the Gospel, he said, it's legend and history have met and fused. Legend and history have met and fused. And I just want to focus on the central event of the myth and try and persuade you that it's a myth that has entered space and time. Because the promised king who dies and rises again, conquering evil once and for all, is also a historical event. The promised king is born into history and geography. He's born in a real place. He's born in Bethlehem. In a real time. We read that Caesar Augustus was doing a census of the Roman world. Places it are between about 8 and 9 BC. We read that Herod the Great was king of the Jews. He was king of the Jews from 40 until 4 BC. So he was born in real history, in a real place. And he lived and did his miracles in real history and geography, in real space and time. We read, as we read the story, a real culture. The Romans occupied Judea, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the religious leaders of the time. The ideas one reads about in the Gospels were real ideas that people had at those times. We read about Jesus casting out evil, a mythical event, but in a real person, in a place called Gadarene. He talks to a woman at a village, a Sychar in Samaria, next to a well, and she can go and sit at that well, on the edge of the well, where Jesus sat as he talked with a woman. And everything that Jesus did is witnessed and recorded by eyewitnesses. Luke writes in his beginning of his gospel, doesn't he, that he wrote it from reports and eyewitnesses, which he's carefully investigated. And when Jesus dies, he dies in a certain way, on a particular day, in a particular place, in real history, in space and time. He was crucified. The account is real when you read it, of a crucifixion. He was stabbed in the side. The blood and water flowing from him is actually a very good physiological account of what happens when you die from asphyxiation. He died in the place of the skull outside Jerusalem when Pontius Pilate was governor. AD 26 to 37 he was governor. Herod Antipas was king of Galilee. He stopped being king of Galilee in AD 39. So we know it happened, this death, in real time, in real space. The myth of the king who dies and is raised from the dead took place in history. And then the most mythical of all events, perhaps the most unbelievable, you might say, the rising from the dead, it happened on a particular day, in a particular place in real history. Again, we read it was 3 days after the crucifixion. It was a Sunday. It was after Passover. It happened in a real place, a tomb in a garden. There were eyewitnesses of the resurrection, people who wrote the Gospel and saw and talked with those who'd seen these events. The Gospels tell us there are even 500 witnesses who saw it. It was no hallucination. It happened in space and time. People talked with Jesus. They ate with him. They drank with him. They walked with him. And it's very strange because actually what they witnessed in real history, because of what they witnessed in real history, they believed Jesus when he said he would come again in real history and make everything new. In fact, they were even prepared to die in real history for what they believed would happen in real history because of what they had seen in real history. And others have recorded these mythical events as facts. Can't go through the evidence now. We were talking a little bit at lunchtime about some of it. But the Jewish historian Josephus records just, the historical person of Jesus and his death, and that some said he was resurrected. Josephus, he talks about the historical person. The actual quote is about four or five lines, but he says, and some said that, that he was raised from the dead. Not necessarily ascribing to the view himself, but Josephus. I mean, if one gets more into Josephus, it's a complex kind of historical argument, and it seems that it might well have been what Josephus said changed at some point, but the nuts and bolts of that are there. People have changed it for a kind of stronger saying of the resurrection, but I think he says some have claimed that he was raised from the dead. One can read, if you'd like to look at that, look at F.F. Bruce's Are the New Testament Documents Reliable, which is still a very short book, but very good about it. It's in the library. Or Craig Blomberg's, I can't remember what it's called, Is the New Testament Reliable or something like that? It just gives you basis. Tacitus, the Roman historian, writing about AD 112, records again a historical person of Jesus and his death. And I find it fascinating that Justin Martyr, who is a Christian, in about AD 150 was in trial in Rome and actually appealed to the records of Pontius Pilate's rule kept in Rome as part of his defense. He was being tried for being a Christian, but he could say, as he stood up in Rome, check out your own records. This person lived and died and was raised from the dead. Even your own accounts talk about him. So part of his defense, he could appeal to history. Just got two more things to say, just to draw it together. So, what Christianity is then, it is a myth, in the sense in which I've relayed what a myth is, but it's a myth that is also fact. And C.S. Lewis, in his essay, which is well worth reading, called When Myth Became Fact, that's in the collection of his essays again, which is in the library, he described Christianity as perfect myth, perfect fact. I like that, perfect myth, perfect fact. So why is it both these things together? You might call it, narrative and propositional, myth and fact, story. It appeals to our imagination and reason. Tolkien said this about human beings. He said, man, the storyteller, would have to be redeemed in a manner consonant with his nature. Let me just read that to you again. Man, the storyteller, would have to be redeemed in a manner consonant with his nature. And I think by that what he meant is that a theological text, you can get out Wayne Grudem's systematic theology, or even if it was, the Lord Jesus' systematic theology, it just wouldn't do it for us, in the sense of, because that's not the whole picture of how we are as human beings. It would appeal perhaps to our abstract knowledge, but it doesn't unite the mind and the experience together, our reason and our imagination, in a way that narrative does, that story does, that myth does. So, myth, in a sense, the story of Christianity, it brings both the experience and the propositional together in one. And that's why I believe the gospel is a story, a narrative. So, as a story or narrative, as a myth, we participate in the gospel. And this is where in a sense, it's sad for so many of us that the actual story of the gospel has been so ruined for so many of us, and we can talk about that later. But as a story, the way it's supposed to be is it's supposed to capture our imagination. It's supposed to fill us with wonder, excite us, inspire us, you know, challenge us. Will we let it form us, change us as a story? But as we participate in the story, reality flows into us and we are changed. You know, as we read about the Titanic struggle of good and evil, we realize that that's a struggle within each of us as well. You know, which side are we going to be on? Who will we side with? We are part of the reality, part of the story, and we must make a choice. Whose side are we on? There's no sitting on the fence when you read the story as it is. So that's as myth, as story, we participate in it. But as fact, we can be sure that the story is true, that good has overcome evil in the real person of Jesus Christ, that evil has been dealt a fatal blow when Jesus was nailed to the cross in real history, that the setting right of everything did begin when Jesus rose from the dead in a real garden on a real Sunday in real history. And we can be sure, just as the disciples were, that Jesus will come again and bring an end to everything in real history and make everything new in real history. So as myth, we participate in it. As fact, you know, we can be confident that these things will happen, have happened, will happen. So in myth and fact, through our mind and emotions, our reason and imagination, what happens, I think, as we read the Bible, read the Gospels, is Jesus invites us to make this choice, both through the abstract, the propositional, and through the story, through our emotions. He combines, addresses, if you like, our reason and imagination together. And here I'm just going to paraphrase a beautiful paragraph by C.S. Lewis. Because he said this. He said, as myth, Jesus claims our wonder and delight. As fact, Jesus claims our love and obedience. As myth, Jesus claims our wonder and delight. As fact, Jesus claims our love and obedience. As myth, Jesus calls to the child, the savage and the poet in us. As fact, he calls to the moralist, the scholar and the philosopher. And I believe if you put those two together, you could say, in myth and fact, he calls to our whole being to make a choice. And he gives us that choice. We can stand by, unwittingly, but always responsible, a pawn of evil. Or we can become a hero. And actually, I think that's the call of the gospel to us, is to become a hero. Not to be a big person and, you know, to do huge things, but to be a little person who through trust and obedience plays his or her vital part in the story. And who knows what that part may be? Did Frodo know, as he accepted the ring one warm summer night in the Shire, what his part would be in the story? You know, does Claudio know, going back to Brazil, having had this experience of Libri, what his part will be there? You know, did I know, as I first came here as a student, aged my early 20s, that I would one day be standing here? Who knows what our part may be? It may be very small, but very, very significant, or very big. We don't know. But what he does call us to do in the Gospels is to play our part in the story with all of our being. To join him on the great adventure, the true quest, and to play our part in the final defeat of evil and the coming of the new kingdom. The Bible terms that redemption, to play our part in redeeming things, you know, one another, being kind to somebody, just a very simple little thing, but part of that plays in redeeming someone and giving them hope. And so that's the choice before us. When Jesus comes again in real history, when all has been said and done and the story has been told to its finish, where will we be? What Jesus says is, come and follow me. And he says, and at the end of that story, just being a little person, bit by bit faithful, obedient, full of wonder, he says, at the end of that story, you'll be welcomed into the fullness of the kingdom with the words of the king. And I think of that time when Frodo at the end, and the hobbits, do you remember, at the end when they're gathered on the top of the palace in Minas Tirith, they appear, and all the people bow, and they kind of look at themselves and say, you know, why are you bowing? You know, we're such little people. But, you know, and Aragorn says, all Middle Earth honors you. And I think it'll be very similar. Once we've walked that faithful step by step, little by little, the king himself will put his hand on our shoulder and say, well done, good and faithful servant, enter into the fullness of your rest, of my rest. That's all I have to say. So you can just have a moment to think about it. And then we can have a few questions. Good. Has anybody got anything they want to ask?
How do you think that the church can recapture, maybe not even the church, but how we can really see the beauty of the story that we have? Because as you were telling it was something that was so attractive and something that captured my imagination, and yet no one gets back. It's not what I heard growing up. It's not what I've always heard. And
Yeah,
what are your thoughts on just sharing that with other people? A way that really captures fact and imagination.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, I mean, that's the question when I give this, I always get asked, you know, how can, perhaps I don't mean that to, sorry, put you down, but it's the logical question, isn't it? How can I recapture the wonder of it? If anybody has children, they usually ask, how can we not stop happening to our children? What happened to you? You know, you get told the story. And yeah, it's I thought quite hard about that. It's not an easy road, but you can do it. What do other people think about ideas of recapturing the wonder? Well, let's open it up. Go, Becky.
I was thinking about how, especially with children, it's sometimes easier. Like, there's one thing, a really great production, like play production of Gospels, and it's coming to life so much as a story.
I think that's part of it, you know, part of it is, start reading it as a story, you know, because again, this is the way often it's taught, you know, in churches, is, you know, mainly it's taught propositionally, you know, pulled apart and kind of like, you know, just this is the moral of the story, or this is the, you know, and then that's just pulled out. But just start reading it as a story. Yeah, maybe actually, you know, I think we can all do, most of us sometimes, switching off the abstract part of our brains, and you know, and kind of that abstract thinking, and actually just enjoy it and enter into the story. And the Gospels are the perfect place to start, and read perhaps, you know, bigger sections, but just as a story, letting it kind of flow into you. Some of you might need to go and buy a different translation of the Bible. You know, if you know the verses so well, you know, that buy something, even go for one of the paraphrases, you know, something like the Message, or in fact the new, the New Living Bible, New Living Translation, yeah. There's also one, Wade often reads that at breakfast, used to when he worked here, and people often say, gosh, you know, it sounds so fresh there. And, yeah, so that kind of thing can help. Yeah, and enter into it, you know, think of it as a story, and maybe read other myths, you know, read other stories, King Arthur, and think about how, you know, I love that the quote that I had there of Tolkien's idea that, you know, the Gospel is the sum of all fairy stories, in a sense, so that everything that's good and true and wonderful about that is actually, is good and true and wonderful about that story because it comes out of the Gospel, if you see what I mean, because it comes out of that, the reality of God. Yeah.
This afternoon, all of the elements of the idea of life and death, redemption, and all of those things are so vivid in there. And I found myself continually going back in my head to sort of Andrew with it, the archetype.
So that, I think that can sometimes excite us, and then, you know, then go back to the Gospels, and then you see the kind of, I just remember reading about the slaughter of the innocent, and just for the first time it kind of like becoming this, realizing, you know, this is this, okay, it's Herod sending his men, but actually it's, you know, this is the forces of evil trying to stamp out the little bit of hope, like the stormtroopers arriving on Tatooine, you know, it's the same thing, and just entering into it again in that way.
But sometimes the big story seems so overwhelming. I remember thinking, I wish I could like make this huge timeline on my wall or something, just trying to figure out how it all fits in. I've done it, but it's, for me, the big story, you know what I mean? From Genesis to the end, how does it really unfold? Especially if it's surrounding us. So I guess if there's a way that we can kind of grasp the big story.
Yeah, getting an idea of the story. Yeah, I mean, if you pick up the Silmarillion, it's got like little charts of family trees and kind of, you know, events and things like that to try and help you through it. And that can be a help, just to help you enter into the story. Because obviously, when you read a story, you know, places are important, aren't they? Geography is important, you know. And then it helps you to enter into even things in the myth, in the Psalms rather, that, you know, helps you enter into what the Psalms are talking about poetically, if you know the kind of history and geography, and one's got to be very creative probably about this.
I think you know, when we read Lord of the Rings, the describing of the setting is so vivid. I think sometimes in scripture it doesn't seem to really come to understand the setting, and I read a fiction book that place two characters in pre-flood times with his family, and reading it and understanding like the culture of living in tents and living this big ark in the middle of the bed is really quite ridiculous. And I mean, it was through fiction that really came alive, because I understood the you know, the mindsets around where they were really living. And I think it really made that part of scripture let me understand it a bit more. It was fiction set in that time. Not even just fiction set at that time, you just read about the time period, even about, you know, the Roman Empire. Jesus was crucified, and understanding that time period.
Yeah, so it's really, because I think what we tended to do is, like, we just abstract everything out of the story, you know, so we just, you know, we take everything out, and we've got, you know, then we've got our 10 bullet points about, you know, the Sermon on the Mount or something, and we nothing, you know, but actually I think this is what we've got to do, is put the, you know, put the propositional truth, if you like, back into the story, because you know, as I said, I mean, Jeff, I think, pointed out very well that the Bible contains both propositional truth and, you know, and a narrative truth, if you like, and but we need to really put them back together. I was thinking about it even personally for us, you know, we need both things in our lives as well, like, you know, there are things that have happened in our story, if you like, in our narrative, like, you know, I was adopted or something like that, okay, you know, which might have affected the way you are today, and that's a very important part of who you are, how that might be. But then there's also this sense of, there are also propositionally things which are true about you, like you are a child of God, you know, which doesn't alter how you feel about it or not. But one needs to have those both together to be fully human. You know, if you were all just, you know, walking around, well, I am a child of God, and that's all you said and knew about yourself, you know, you wouldn't be, it would be true, but it wouldn't be the full picture. You know, there's all kinds of things. So even in our own lives, we need to hold the narrative story of our lives and what's propositionally true together. And so, yeah, we need to put, you know, things. I mean, Casey, you go to a church which preaches kind of narrative theology preaching, which is a kind of growing idea, can sometimes go the other way, can't it, and kind of lose the propositional. But I like what you said about, I mean, I don't know if you want to say a little word just about, but I like the way you said that, what, you know, at the end of a sermon, it's kind of asking, you know, well, what is God saying to us here now as these people in this place, in our, like, little story, in a sense, you know, from what we've heard from the big story. Is that kind of how you put, I don't know how you express it.
Like the story, like, we, instead of reading the story, let the story, let's read you, like, take the story upon in your own life, and what does it mean for me? You know, not just what does it mean for me, like, in an out there way, but what does this mean for us? Like,
yeah.
If we're taking the story to be our own.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Sort of, here's
the story that
we're actually
tell each other and
believe
and
live around. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but you leave sometimes you leave with a sense of, I'm not really sure what to do with this.
Right, yeah.
It's a good
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, if you can have those two together, then kind of, it's really powerful, isn't it? You know, to say to, you know, not just what is this passage saying to all of us, you know, be kind to one another, but actually, what is it saying to us as a group of Christians, you know, in this place, in this time, right now? And the church I went to in London, we, you know, that was one of the best things about church, was asking, you know, what does God want us to do with the story of the gospel as this church, you know, on this corner of street amongst these tower blocks of, you know, kind of, what would you call them, you know, kind of deprived area of London, you know, and the answer was, you know, that people felt that God was calling the church to work with children in the area, and that was, and work in the arts as well, and work artistically with children. And so they did all kinds of things, which is, I mean, very interesting things, again, using, like, they did a, like, the passion, you know, a passion play where you follow Jesus through, we did that in the local adventure playground, and a passion play, so I had characters, you know, who are playing Jesus, and you follow him from scene to scene, and the disciples around. And then they also made a film of the Book of Esther with the children, and put it on at the local cinema, and, you know, as it, with a kind of gala night opening, and invited all their parents along. You know, the children had, it was no, there was no kind of, like, abstracted teaching to them about, you know, these are kids from the estates and the schools, this is what the Book of Esther means. But they imbibed, you know, I think that's what C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and I would say, they took in reality, you know, through just engaging with the story. And I think, you know, this is some ways in Protestant churches where we've lost out, and where Catholics are actually stronger, is like, I mean, I like the idea of the Stations of the Cross, for example, as a very powerful, we were, in this church I went to as well, it's probably the most moving, I don't know, maybe changed me more service than anything else, certainly changed that. We had it was a kids service, right, for Easter, a couple of weekends before Easter, for the 5 to 8 year olds or something. And they had, like, one guy dressed up as Jesus, And he was a guy from the church who did some amateur acting. I mean, in some ways it was awful. They had like a pantomime donkey. And then, you know, it sounds terrible. But Jesus went round. It's a small, wasn't, not as maybe half again as big as this room, not a big room. And the kids all give him palm branches and then went round. And in fact, everybody in the church did, all the adults did it as well, followed Jesus. And then the children all sat there around a table with Jesus, and he blessed orange juice and biscuits and gave it to them and said, you know, here's my body I'm giving, here's my blood. And the children, you know, joined in with the Last Supper. And then the soldiers came and took Jesus. And the kids then followed him around, followed the soldiers. And then they crucified him. And then they took him down. It was really very, so beautiful. They took him down, you know, dead, and put him in this tomb, which again was just, you know, was so kind of, was like almost cardboard and kind of wood cut out in the corner with a few cloths draped over it. And they rolled the stone across. And then they said, and then on the third day the women came to the tomb and the stone was rolled away. And now Jeremy, who was Jesus, had just crawled out the back of this kind of tomb structure behind a covering. But the tomb was empty when the stone was rolled away, and the kids were like, wow. And all the adults, it was amazing. They were just all kind of, you know, and then the kids could get into the tomb. You know, the kids could go inside and kind of like, you know, knocking the sides and finding out. And then while they were doing that, it was just brilliantly done. While they were doing that, Jesus just appeared amongst them. And the kids kind of came out of the tomb, and then he was there. And then, you know, and the kids were just, it was, you know, were overjoyed, and the adults were all in tears. And then Jack, on the way home, we were driving home near Regent's Park, and he just was sitting in the back of the car, and he said, the soldiers killed Jesus, but he was alive again. And I just thought, and he was only three, he was less than 3 and a half at the time. I just thought, wow, you know, he's got something there, he's got the heart of the gospel, it's brilliant, you know. And so, yeah, I think, you know, as allowing ourselves, in a sense, as adults again, to enter into the story, yeah, we've got to find ways of doing that, really.
Jim, one thing that I've been thinking a lot about as I play through more and more stories myself is kind of what you said about how you wish we could be in the
story.
And that can kind of reach a frustrating point.
Mm.
I find myself reading this from the alien and saying, why am I reading? This is like history text a place that doesn't exist. Why am I reading this?
Yeah.
And I think I kind of stopped reading the gospel for a while because in a sense, I felt like I needed to kind of drown it with just story in my life, in a sense. And what I'm finding, I think, is that I can't be in those stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's making me having to face my actual reality, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only story I have that applies to that is God, the gospel.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess that is what is driving me, I guess.
Mm.
I still don't see the gospel in the way I want to. I don't see it.
Yeah.
But I think I'll get there.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that would be the ultimate goal for me, to be able to see it better.
Yeah.
Because it is my reality.
Yeah.
It isn't just.
Yeah.
It isn't just a story.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really wonderful thing about the gospel. You know, I mean, you can't live in Middle Earth, even though we tried the other night, and we tried pretty well. But Sam's elf ears, I'm sure, getting pretty sore within about an hour or two. So you can't live in that story. But the amazing thing about the gospel is this is actually a story which Jesus calls you to live in, you know, because it's reality. And he invites you. That's the call of the gospel, is come and live in this story. And I mean, I want to do a second lecture after this called, which is kind of learning to see our lives as heroic myths. Because I think that's probably where, again, we need to move towards it, is see that, like, if you like, we have the big story, which we must live within. in the same way, the big story is the story of the gospel, if you like. It gives our life meaning and purpose and frames everything. But then it's not just the big story, because if you, some Christians, you know, just talk about the big story, and then it crushes you as an individual. But actually, you as an individual, your little story is very, very important. You know, and your little story as you walk little by little, bit by bit, you know, it's just like Frodo going to Mount Doom, or just like, you know, it's actually very, very important. It's, you know, there's so many instances again of the little faithfulness of people in the gospel. And this is how God's chosen to do his work of redeeming the world. It's actually through, you know, through you guys who have chosen to follow Christ, those of you have here, is he's going to fulfill his big story through your little stories. And that doesn't mean you have to go out and do big things. It just means do your little things, but do them faithfully, you know, well. And but also, it's not just the little story, because otherwise, you know, in our little story, sometimes we can just become narcissistic. You know, if everything's the little story, everything revolves around us, and ultimately we lose all meaning and purpose. So just the big story crushes us as individuals, but just our little story, there's no meaning and purpose really. It makes us insignificant. But the two together, you know, living out your little story faithfully within the big story gives, you know, individuality, meaning and purpose. You know.
Yeah. I once asked some lady in that was doing very kind of the old job, very repetitious job, how they kept they did their job very quickly and precisely.
Yeah.
And they seemed to enjoy it, and that's how they did that.
Yeah.
He said that for him was acceptance really of what he was, where he was and what he was doing.
Yeah.
I think it's like that choice, you know, whether it's like the hobbits that, you know, the choice to go one step further. All those little choices that add up to a big, to such a big way.
Yeah, and it makes, you know, makes everything in a sense in our little story significant, in the sense of, you know, the way we treat people, and the you know, that we love someone becomes a significant, very significant event within the big story, you know, a very little thing. So any last question, or shall we call it a very cold night? Yeah, Joyce, yeah.
I wish I'd dreamed of this thing myself, but I heard it from somebody else in the story. As Christians, we have hope because we know we're on the winning side, because we've read today in the book.
Yeah.
Think about what we're doing, because we know how it's going to win.
And in a sense, that's what hope is, isn't it? It's believing in the ending, if you like, even though it's very hard now. You know, we must take this painful step by step, whether we're, you know, bearing a ring, a burden, which we must, you know, must be, you know, dying, must be killed off, or whether we're, you know, kind of in a phase of our life that's very full of joy, and this life can vary between the two, but you're right, yeah. Knowing the end is hope, yeah. Let me pray on that note, and then we'll finish for the evening. Lord God, we we just come before you and pray for your help. For many of us, the story has been so killed, so flattened. And I pray you just give us and teach us and show us ways in which we can recapture the wonder and the sense of the drama, the emotions of the big story. And for others of us, you know, everything is just our story, and we need to re-engage with what's true outside of ourselves. And so I pray, whichever way we need, that you would teach us and lead us on, so that we can be united people, full of wonder in our imagination and full of hope in our reason, and then just walking step by step with you through life to the end that is yeah, that is true. So I pray, help us. Amen.